I'm very happy now to welcome Valerie Plame Wilson. She's an author and former CIA operations officer and retired Ambassador Joe Wilson. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Always good to have you on the program. Now, we're talking today about a campaign called Global Zero. What's it all about?
I am so proud to be a leader in Global Zero. It's a nonpartisan, non-political organization that seeks the ultimate elimination of nuclear weapons worldwide. What I love about them is that they draw from truly an international cohort. Everyone from Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of Pakistan Musharraf, Queen Noor, James Baker, former Secretary of State,
George
students,
Schultz.
This is not a political issue. This is an issue of people that say we cannot continue the way we are. We have been lucky for decades. And as we have seen just in the last few weeks, the ratcheting up of tensions in North Korea, that luck may run out soon due to miscalculation.
Kidding.
And the only surefire long-term solution to proliferation is to eliminate all nuclear weapons.
One of the things that I thought was an interesting turn of phrase in the literature about Global Zero was this idea of the nuclear proliferation tipping point.
Well, a little bit of history. The world had about 70,000 to 80,000 nuclear weapons at the height of the Cold War. Ironically, in some ways, because it was very much a bipolar world, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and there was something called the Mutually Assured Destruction Doctrine, MAD, which I always thought was, aptly
appropriate,
named. Appropriate.
Yeah.
Despite the thousands of nuclear weapons, they were under very good security procedures and protocols and so forth. What happened when the Soviet Union fell and fractured? Everyone sort of went, we don't need to worry about this issue anymore. The days of protests in Central Park, hundreds of thousands of people in the mid-80s to say, we don't want nuclear weapons anymore, went away. What has happened in the interval, in the interim until where we are today, is that nuclear technology has proliferated worldwide, and there has been the emergent and insistent threat of terrorists getting a hold of this nuclear technology. So although there are far fewer weapons in the world today, due in a large part to the New START Treaty, which was just ratified last year, and continued cuts in the U.S.-Russian arsenal, we have now 9 declared nuclear states. And many of them are in hands of rogue states.
Now,
or unstable states. In the case of North Korea, it's certainly a rogue regime.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Pakistan, it's one that's inherently and fundamentally unstable right now. The situation on the Korean Peninsula is really particularly instructive. It's focusing the minds of a lot of the big international players,
mm-hmm.
including the Russians, who have spoken out really rather severely on the subject. That provides a potential opening for people like Global Zero to continue to encourage the possibility of multilateral talks between these among the nuclear mm-hmm. nations to figure out how you build down these nuclear arsenals.
One of the things that I think happens because we tend to think in polarized ways, left and right, liberal, conservative, is that people will inadvertently or just out of ignorance frame this as a left versus right issue, as the peaceniks versus the military. Mm-hmm. But when you look at who is working on Global Zero and who is in favor of the elimination of nuclear weapons, you find people on every single part of the political spectrum.
Exactly, and that's what makes Global Zero so effective. It draws from the ranks of the military, former prime ministers, foreign ministers, students. I was fortunate enough to work with Queen Noor last fall in Belgium, and we spoke to students, top students from all around European countries that have been selected, a very rigorous selection process, to come for a week's worth of training, and then they'll go back to their respective universities to begin Global Zero chapters on their campuses. But you're absolutely right. This is not a political issue, and it shouldn't be played up that way. Global Zero has managed to transcend that and go beyond what has been historically nuclear arms control, which really has, frankly, been in the province of old white men.
The other thing about the supporters of Global Zero that's important to sort of recognize is a lot of them have actually had their fingers on the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who have been in positions where they make decisions on whether or not you use nuclear weapons. So they have the authority to do so. They were in command positions.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives them, I think, a certain added credibility in the discussion, in the conversation on the subject.
There was something that I thought was so interesting and very important about that film Gatekeepers that came out recently. One of the former intelligence directors of the Nation of Israel basically said, you know, when warriors get old, we become kind of pacifists. And I see that so often is people who have been real warriors, who have been in the military, who have been in these establishments. They get older, they see the folly of trying to solve problems
through violence,
and they want to do something else, and then the next generation of young people is coming in and saying, no, we've got to fight.
I'll just step in to say it is my hope that as human beings, as we go through life, you evolve, you continue to learn, and hopefully at the end of your life, you're a little bit wiser, and that would include understanding that violence and the genuine horrors of war we cannot continue down that path. And nuclear war is something that we cannot comprehend what that would mean. If even a dirty bomb was such a thing, the explosive power would not kill thousands. But if a dirty bomb were to go off in any city in the world, Mumbai, New York, Madrid, the psychological ripples from that of the fear and the denigration of the rights that we take for granted in democracies, I think would vanish overnight.
We're talking to Valerie Plame Wilson and Joe Wilson. So what is the game plan for getting rid of nuclear weapons?
Just a few days ago, it was the fourth anniversary of President Obama giving his first major foreign policy speech when he first became president. It was in Prague, April 5th, 2009, and before tens of thousands of cheering Czechs, he spoke about a world without nuclear weapons. I mean, that was really profound. I just found out recently that he, in fact, wrote his senior thesis at Columbia University on the Soviet-U.S. Nuclear conundrum. So this is something he believes in personally. Global Zero, happily, is not let's just hold hands and hope for the best. They are very gimlet-eyed about how to proceed. There is an entire plan that was, in fact, presented before Congress last year by General Cartwright, among others, talking about how to step this down in an orchestrated fashion and institute an international very intrusive inspections regime. You need to have everyone on board to be able to say that, just like we did with chemical and biological weapons, that this is absolutely taboo. And those that are outside of the international community that agree to this will simply die on the vine.
So is everybody agreed to it?
It's getting a lot of push. We are doing a big media rollout for your listeners that are interested. They can go to globalzero.org. There's a brief, like, 2-minute video narrated by Michael Douglas, and it shows people what they can do, how they can push their elected officials, because this has to ultimately come from grassroots level.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I was going to say the public has been more and less conscious of the issue of nuclear weapons over the course of my lifetime. It sort of goes in and out of, I don't want to say fashion, but out of people's media consciousness. Mm-hmm. Where are we now?
I think there is, because of the terrorist threat, I think there is, and certainly now with North Korea, a heightened understanding of what it means to have nuclear proliferation. When you have countries such as Pakistan, where its command and control systems are inherently unstable and the country is ready to implode, a regime like North Korea, which is highly unpredictable, it's a cult masquerading as a state, what does that really mean? What if you had a nuclear weapon lobbed? The most likely scenario is we understand North Korea has not been able to miniaturize their nuclear weapons. However, they can have a range of about 1,000 miles, which means they could reach Japan or Seoul or, South Korea. What does that mean?
And what does that mean? I mean, the human, you talked about the fear that would be instilled in people's hearts worldwide. The human damage and the environmental damage are also massive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why, and that's why the Korean Peninsula is so interesting as a backdrop to Global Zero, because people are now realizing that there is a guy who nobody knows much about, who is threatening to use whatever nuclear arsenal he may have against strategic U.S. interests and perhaps the U.S., U.S. bases in South Korea, if he can get to Guam. Mm-hmm. The reaction that that would provoke would obviously be devastating. But just being there sharpens everybody's mind to think about this. And I go back to what the Russians have been saying to the North Koreans about it, how out of bounds this sort of behavior really is.
For me, when I worked in the CIA, this is my field of expertise. I worked on nuclear counterproliferation. And I have to admit that at the time I was so deep into operations, I was really just worried about delaying, deterring, coming up with creative covert action. It's much more immediate. But as I have moved away and moved on, I've come to the conclusion, I've evolved, where I believe now we must drain the swamp. That is the only possible way ahead. You have to move toward the ultimate elimination of nuclear weapons.
So what then happens to the weapons, to the nuclear materials?
You have to lock down all the highly enriched uranium. You have to lock down. This is where an international regime is absolutely critical. Everyone agrees to it. The Non-Proliferation Treaty is unsustainable. I won't go into details because it's a little complicated. It's a two-tier system. It's not working. What Global Zero has asked of President Obama is that as he begins to think through his legacy, of which will be significant on many different fronts, but here is one where if he could pull together the leaders of nuclear nations and begin international nuclear arms reduction talks, it's not going to happen next week or next year, but you begin this path somewhere. I mean, it's analogous to gun control. You have to begin somewhere.
Well, it is analogous to gun control on a number of levels, because it brings up really big philosophical questions about what is security. And people who aren't in favor of gun control think the more guns you have, the more secure you are. Mm-hmm. And then the other side thinks the more guns you have, the less secure you are. And it's the same kind of thing on a much larger scale.
I just heard of a news story just a few days ago. A small city in Georgia, Nelson, maybe 1,500 people, apparently very peaceful. There's been no violent crime there for the last decade. But the city council just passed an ordinance whereby every head of household must be armed. So I don't want to pull us off track away from the nuclear issue, but it goes to that philosophical issue of, if you will, an arms race, whether you're in a small town in rural Georgia or you are Japan and South Korea going, our really irrational, crazy neighbor to the north is threatening us with, it's an existential threat. Maybe we too should have nuclear weapons. And that gets us in a downward spiral, and you can see something like that happen as well in another volatile region, the Middle East. I blink away from that.
A question that I think is also important to discuss is what is the economic reality of keeping nuclear weapons? How much does it cost our society? How much does it cost the world to be spending money on these things?
A whole bunch of money is the answer. Our nation alone will spend over $600 billion the next decade. That's just maintaining. That's sort of like polishing your plutonium pits and making sure the facilities are in good condition and so forth. I don't know about you, but I can think about a couple more places I would love to see that $600 billion go, be it job creation, education, environmental concerns. Of course, you know, the list is long.
New Mexico public school system.
Yeah, there you go. But it's worldwide. The United Kingdom is seriously reconsidering the whole Trident nuclear sub because the cost is crushing. And as we know, the United Kingdom is experimenting with some severe austerity measures on their current government, Cameron. Are we going to look like North Korea, where every single resource is poured into a militaristic regime at the expense, in North Korea certainly, of literally millions of people dying of starvation?
Right. Now, what would happen, what would this mean for Los Alamos? Let's say we were to be successful in eliminating nuclear weapons. Global Zero is successful.
I'm not an expert on this, but as a civilian with a great deal of interest, I look at what happened with the Manhattan Project. And within about 18 months, they went from drawing on the chalkboard of the concept of the splitting of the atom to 18 months approximately, the Trinity site detonation test, the proof of concept. We threw incredible brains, talent, resources into that, and it worked. You can have a debate about whether dropping the bombs on Nagasaki, Hiroshima, ended the war. Was that a good decision, and so forth? That's a different conversation. But it is clear that when we devote ourselves to solving a problem, we can. And we have these beautiful labs in New Mexico, at Sandia, at Los Alamos, and scattered elsewhere across the country, that wouldn't it be wonderful, for instance, to see, well, what could we do with alternative energy?
Right.
I think that's right. At Los Alamos and Sandia, you have an enormously talented populations, and there would be lots of interesting things for them to do, and I'm quite sure.
Which I think a lot of them are actually dying to do.
Yeah
break out of their now, half a century long strictures.
Now, Obama is in favor of this, although he's a busy guy and has a lot of things to do besides this. What about Secretary of Defense Hagel?
Hagel was a founding member of Global Zero, which is absolutely thrilling to us. I think he will be an outstanding Secretary of Defense, not just on this issue, but across the board. Clearly, his plate is full. But the fact that he was a founding member of Global Zero, has signed on, and was, in fact, part of that report that was presented before Congress. It was called the Cartwright Report last year, to talk about how the New START Treaty will bring the United States arsenal from about 5,500 active nuclear warheads, cut it in half to about 2,500. The Cartwright Report then explores possibilities for bringing it down beyond that. That's when people start getting nervous, and we need to proceed prudently. But I believe it can be done. I mean, I'm not willing, I'm an optimist maybe. I'm not willing to say, well, forget about it. I want to be able to say I did whatever little bit I could.
We're talking to Valerie Plame Wilson and Joe Wilson about Global Zero. So let's say we get rid of nuclear weapons. Then we're left with drones and bombers and missiles and things that maybe 100 years ago would have been considered the most evil weapons of mass destruction that anybody could have imagined. We still have
really good
a
ways of killing people.
Armed warrior state.
That's absolutely true. What is called for in that vacuum would obviously be enhanced, and I'll let Joe speak to this, diplomatic efforts. For instance, take two nuclear armed states, India and Pakistan. They are both armed because They find being in the nuclear club is prestigious. And there's a long simmering issue, of course, border issues between the two countries that threatens to boil over any, on any given week or month. But I think even without nuclear weapons, would still be plenty of ways to kill people. It's not a problem.
I think the building down of the Pentagon budget is a very important thing to do. It is diverting way too many resources. It's a self-licking ice cream cone. It's there because it's there. And it's never survived an audit, and certainly not since World War II, I don't believe. It's never had an audit. You can't audit it. So we have to have some.
Why
really
can't
serious,
you audit it?
It's so vast.
It's just so vast. They have been unable to do it in the last 20 years. And there's some serious and smart people who work in there. It's a long-term problem. We're over-militarized. What we spend relative to other nations is simply unsustainable in terms of projecting our values the way we want to project them.
What's the statistic that our military budget, our defense budget,
our
equals the next 10 nations in the world?
Combined.
Right.
And our cost overruns would be the third largest defense budget in the world. I just heard that last night.
Good heavens!
So that's an undemocratic value, basically, and it's just is occupying more and more of our space and of our resources, and it's unhealthy. We need more diplomacy, which is not nearly as sexy. We need more sort of collective security arrangements, regional collective security arrangements,
and economic.
The Indians and the Pakistanis should be in talks 24 hours a day, every day of the week, until they get to know each other and have enough confidence that they're not going to be invading each other. They just need to do that.
It also requires on the part of, diplomacy is a necessity, and also starting to see diplomacy as a value, teaching conflict resolution in schools, and getting out of that cliche, it's like when you're a hammer, everything you see looks like a nail. Mm-hmm. When you're a military power, every conflict should be resolved through military power. And maybe you too can speak to the long-term results of our over-militarized state.
Well, I think the long-term results have been seen in the last decade in the two wars that we've waged in Afghanistan, and in particular the Iraq War. I think what Secretary Clinton tried to do in the 4 years that she was secretary was restore some modicum of American leadership in the international community. I think in the aftermath of the Iraq War, again in particular, the moral authority of the United States collapsed. Correctly so. You cannot continue to respect, if you're a foreigner, a country like the United States that produces things like Abu Ghraib and this ill-advised invasion of Iraq. I think that leadership evaporated and moral authority evaporated just as soon as we did shock and awe. So we have to build that back. We are, rather than being admired for the democratic ideals that we have espoused diplomatically, we're now seen as just another militaristic nation that is prepared to invade foreign countries for commercial gain. That makes us no better than any other country that populations have either been invaded by in the past or have invaded other countries. That's hard to recover that moral authority. And that's, I think, the real reason that Hillary Clinton was in 112 countries in 4 years and logged over a million miles long.
Personal relationships, building and rebuilding those personal relationships.
It's also hard to recover if you're trying to say the words but not do the actions. I mean, when you think about, for example, climate change, the United States could take leadership on climate change that would change the world in a couple of years.
Profound.
And we can talk all we want, but we're not doing it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, everybody else is way ahead of us.
Oh, I think worse than that. In addition to not doing anything about it, we're doing things to make it worse. I think this fracking that's going on is a very untested technology. And I think they're way ahead of where they should be in terms of developing it as a resource.
And as we sit here in New Mexico, where we have an abundance of sunshine and not a whole lot else,
right.
How is it that we are not, us and others in the Southwest, are not leading the world in solar technology? Instead, I think that's gone to Germany now, which has, you know, like three sunny days a year.
My mother's German, and there's a saying in Germany, last year, summer fell on a Tuesday.
Precisely. So when you talk about, gee, how could we refocus the labs on alternative energy, it's all possible.
Now, the Global Zero campaign has a lot going for it. You get rid of the threat of nuclear war, you get rid of the costly nuclear apparatus, you have a different kind of security, you start thinking about winding down the idea of being militarized states in the first place. What's not to like? Who's against this?
The usual suspects, those in conservative think tanks that put out a steady barrage of papers and thought pieces on why America has to continue to manufacture and maintain and, in fact, build up our nuclear arsenal, because it's prestigious, because it keeps us safe. And, you know, meanwhile, as our infrastructure crumbles around us and education begins to fall further and further behind, I just think it's not sustainable.
And nobody in elementary schools or high schools knows where North Korea is on a map.
That's exactly right.
There you go.
Valerie Plame Wilson is a former CIA operations officer, author. You've got a new book coming out this fall.
Yes, Blowback with Sarah Lovett. And we can't wait. It's going to be a spy thriller.
Excellent. And retired Ambassador Joe Wilson has been joining us. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. And you can find out more information at globalzero.org. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Mike Marcucci. He's producer of the film 16 Acres, which screens tomorrow night, Wednesday at 7 o'clock at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate that. It's great to be with you.
So I love this film. It's a really great story. It's a documentary about the intense controversies surrounding what should happen at Ground Zero in New York after 9/11. When did the making of this film begin?
Well, the production of this documentary formally began about 2.5 years ago, but I myself have been involved in filming activities at the World Trade Center since 2004. I've worked for many of the stakeholders. I've worked for the Port Authority, worked for the 9/11 Memorial Museum, and I worked for Silverstein Properties, and that got me all the access to the cast of characters in my movie.
Ah, very interesting. Okay, that makes sense, because all the players are in this movie, and what you have is a picture of the kind of emotional needs of the various concerned parties after 9/11, which basically meant pretty much everybody in New York. What were some of the options that people were considering to address the post-9/11 needs?
Well, the film itself is a history of all the conflicting ideas for what to do with the site. I mean, we were left with this. New York was left with this giant vacuum. This terrible, tragic event had happened, and everyone standing around looking at this pile of rubble and wondering what to do. So our film shows the various points of view of the politicians, of the real estate developers, of the people who lost family members, and they all had various ideas of what to do, and often it became contentious, because everyone wanted to do something different, but they all had their heart in the right place, but they definitely had different agendas.
And some of them were saying, let's turn it into a green field of memory, and some others were saying, let's build towers even taller than the ones before.
Right. Well, the Mayor Giuliani originally, in his farewell address, said that he thought the entire site should just be one big, beautiful park and memorial, and a lot of family members felt that way too. But then you also had family members who said, no, no, we have to rebuild or else we look like we're surrendering. And then you had the, you know, the real estate developer who saw the business leaving downtown Manhattan like rats leaving a ship, and he said, we got to rebuild right away because, you know, we don't want the city to suffer this great loss of jobs. And so, yeah, everybody had thoughts, but, I think at the end of the day, I think my movie shows that there was some compromise between everybody.
Right, right. Now, one of the things, and I don't want to, I mean, a lot of us out here haven't, a lot of people have never been to New York or haven't been there for a long time, and so I don't want to give away all of what actually happens, which of course is still in progress, but I mean, the question of who was in charge was incredibly complicated. Who were some of the various players who had responsibility for Ground Zero?
Well, essentially, it was up to Larry Silverstein as the leaseholder. He signed a 99-year lease with the Port Authority, who owned the land. And so as the leaseholder, he was in charge of putting things back according to his lease. But then you have the governor and the mayor who took the lead as well. So I would say ultimately it probably the governor and the Port Authority had the supreme control, but Silverstein had lease control, in terms of his lease. So I'd say that, the people in my movie are the mayor, the governor, and the leaseholder, Larry Silverstein, as the big decision makers.
It's really, this documentary, a saga of grand politics on so many levels, and how the governor of New York was trying to use this as a kind of political football to his advantage, and then there are all of these people who'd lost family in 9/11 who had a lot to say about how this site should be rebuilt. And I think the film is really fair to everybody who's in it. And I have to say, watching this, I never thought I'd be sympathetic with the kind of gazillionaire real estate developers. But when you watch Larry Silverstein and Yano Lieber, you see these very practical people who are just trying to get things done and not partake so much in the grandstanding, of which there was a great deal during that whole time.
Yes, well, we tried our best, and I hope succeeded, to be fair to everybody. I mean, we really wanted to pretty much lay it out very evenly and let the viewer decide, who they thought, was right or wrong. But yeah, we tried to be fair, and essentially, the governor acted like a politician would, and the developer acted like a developer would, and and so on. Everybody behaved, the way they, their profession dictates. So, and they were all, right in their own perspective. But, like I said, we tried to be very, very even and fair. And some characters you wouldn't expect to be sympathetic towards. You start to understand why some of these people did what they did.
It's really all in all a kind of loving portrait of New York City and its many manifestations of money and power and people's passions and emotions, and then regular people and people fighting and finally working things out. Is there still that kind of fighting going on, or has it reached a kind of consensus and sense of moving forward?
Well, the site is a history of ups and downs, of starts and stalls, and currently we're at a very good place. Everybody is getting along, and building is going on at a quite kinetic pace. So at this stage, everything is working out just fine. And but there's still several years to go. But at this stage, it's all good.
How has the film been received in New York?
The film has been received very well in New York, and actually, you know, in Europe too. We had our premiere in Zurich in September, and I was shocked at how much, you know, people in Zurich knew about it. But the funny thing about New Yorkers, and this is one of the reasons why I did the movie, was most New Yorkers tuned out many years ago. They just threw their hands up in the air and said, you know, these guys are just fighting and it's never going to get done. And I just don't, you know, just don't even read about it anymore. So, you know, I used to tell people I worked here and they had no idea that buildings were going up and that Seven World Trade Center has been finished since 2006. So that was really the motivation for making the movie, was to sort of tell this story of the most famous construction site, but yet the most least understood. And New Yorkers were the most uneducated because they tuned out.
That's so interesting. I mean, there's this great scene in the movie where there's an architectural competition for what buildings should be built there, and the competition photographs of the competition finalists of their work were in, what, every major newspaper on the planet Earth?
Right, right. Well, that was early on. You know, the first few years, you know, there was a lot of movement. You know, they cleared the site very quickly. They came up, you know, they got a competition going. And we show a lot of the unusual designs that came up. But then things started bogging down, you know, around 2004, 2005. And you know, the New Yorkers, like I said, tuned out. But I think that, you know, the buildings that they did come up with are quite beautiful. We have a beautiful site that's coming up in New York.
Mike Marcucci is producer of the film 16 Acres, which screens tomorrow night, Wednesday, at 7 o'clock at the CCA right here in Santa Fe. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. I just wanted to say thank you, too, to Jason Silverman at the Contemporary Arts Center. I appreciate the showing, and thank you again.
Excellent. Yes, shout out to the fabulous Jason Silverman, who's bringing some of the best movies ever to Santa Fe. I'd like now to welcome James Titus. He's a student at Santa Fe Community College at the School of Liberal Arts and Core Studies. And we are here to talk about Earth Week and Solar Fiesta. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
So Earth Week is an entire week that goes from Monday, April 22nd through that Friday, the 26th, at the community college. What is going on?
Well, it's actually our second annual event for Earth Week to have it be an entire week. It's actually going to be Monday through Thursday is the actual Earth Week. That Friday is going to be an overlapping Earth Week / Solar Fiesta. And then that weekend, the Saturday and Sunday, will be the Solar Fiesta. So the Earth Week is an international event. Earth Day is Monday, April 22nd,
right,
celebrated internationally, a day to celebrate the planet, Mother Earth, that was started in 1970, based off Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which was about DDT and pollution and poisons. So out of that, now we've gone from just one or two days into an entire week of celebrating the Earth and awareness, educating people, motivating people to care.
Now, of course, water plays a large role in the activities. What are some of the water events that are going on?
We're going to be doing on Tuesday between 11 and 12, Tuesday, April 23rd, Claudia Borche from the City of Santa Fe Water Division will be doing a presentation talking about the Santa Fe Water Basin and giving some information about conservation, what's going on with the water basin, and just in general where we're at with our water supplies here in Santa Fe.
And there's all sorts of other activities, including some fun stuff and some movies and things like that. And it's not only for students, but for the whole community.
Yeah, that's one reason why I want to promote this and get the word out that it's not just for students of Santa Fe Community College. Santa Fe Community College is hosting the event. However, this is open. It's free. It's open to anybody and everybody who wants to participate. The more the merrier. We want to get as many people in the community as possible. And I emphasize community. This is really involves everybody. And every state will be doing their own thing. But we want to get as many people from New Mexico as possible, especially from Santa Fe.
Now, one of the things, and there's things called Veducation and and the movie Chasing Ice will be shown, which is a very important and very interesting movie, and the movie Flow will be shown. There's also a Trio-a-thon. What's that?
The Trio-a-thon is going to be a walk that is it's going to be between 2:30 and 3 on Tuesday, April 23rd, and it's a walk for the Campus Cupboard, which is basically people bring donations of canned goods, non-perishable items for students and families and community members that just don't have enough to eat. And unfortunately, there's too much of that going on. So the Trio-a-thon is doing a great thing, and that's also open to everybody who wants to get out there, put on your walking shoes, and walk for hunger.
And there's
to stop hunger.
Right, exactly. There's a meditation training in the fitness center. There are drummers and some kind of fun, entertaining stuff. How did the students come together, the students and faculty, to put this whole week together? What was that process like?
Well, our coordinator is Janet Berry, and it's a growing, living organism. You know, like I said, this is our second year, and we're adding more than we did last year. It's just something that Santa Fe Community College and the officials of the college are behind this, because Santa Fe Community College is really about being green. They want to emphasize, you know, eventually that they're going to be going zero waste. So they're behind initiatives that are going to be educating people. And that's the whole thing, is education mixed with entertainment. To make it
zero waste?
Zero waste.
How does that work?
Well, zero waste works that every piece of trash has a place, that nothing should be going into the landfill, that we could have all of the scraps of food being used for composting. Every type of packaging material can be recycled on some level. Basically having, you know, and eventually trying to stop a lot of that prepackaged foods and material that can't be recycled. So that's another focus too, is to stop buying these products that can't be recycled and try to find other uses for those. But the school's behind an initiative. Eventually, it's something that's in progress that they're working towards. So basically, you will have nothing in the trash, nothing going to the landfills, that everything will have a use. And it'll be focusing on composting, because
right.
The earth itself doesn't create any pollution, any waste. It's a natural recycler.
That is a very ambitious goal, considering how much, I mean, just in our own household trash, how much non-recyclable stuff there is, even when we're trying to be conscious. Institutions have a much greater problem.
Yeah, absolutely. It is an ambitious goal, and yet it's an achievable goal.
What happens to, just out of curiosity, what happens to the paper towels that you use to dry your hands with?
Well, in my house, they get used to start fires. in other places, yeah, they end up in the landfill. You know, it's just something, or you know, but they have a short shelf life.
I mean, could they be used for biofuels at the college? I mean,
there is a big biofuels program at Santa Fe Community College, and it's also a growing thing. Eventually, they're going to start doing the plastic to fuels, which will be a great thing. I want to mention also that on that Wednesday, the 24th, the president of the Environmental Club, Mary Kearns, and one of the executives from the Environmental Club, Sage Bird, will be doing an art project. And one of the things is we're collecting non-recyclable items like yogurt containers, lids to juice, just various pieces of plastic and non-recyclable stuff to be used as an art project. So trying to make use of these things that otherwise would be a negative, turning it into a positive.
We're talking to James Titus of Santa Fe Community College. Let's talk for a moment about the Solar Fiesta, which is that weekend, April 27th and 28th. What's happening there?
That's going to be 2 days of workshops, tours, and exhibits. And it's the New Mexico Solar Energy Association. grouping with the Santa Fe Community College. And it's going to be Saturday the 27th and Sunday the 28th with various events going on, talking about solar air conditioning, zero and low energy new home construction, xeriscaping, which is a huge thing in New Mexico, water efficiency, which is is a passion of mine. I can't emphasize enough. The solar program is the sustainable program is run by Zuby Wilson, and it's we have the new trades and technology building. We'll be doing a tour of this new green building, which is really advanced. It's great. It utilizes solar power, solar panels. It's where they have the algae labs. All the biofuels stuff program goes on there. So they're going to be doing tours and letting people know about what's going on there. You know, what is the college doing? How does it work?
So you're a student in Santa Fe Community College. You're about to graduate and go on to UNM. How did you get interested in environmental concerns, and what are you planning to do when you move on?
Well, first, what I'm planning to do when I move on is to further study environmental science, environmental planning and design, and things that what I can do and what every individual can do to make this planet better than where we found it, you know, and finding viable solutions to the problems. There's real problems facing us, but there's solutions to all these problems, and I want to learn more about that. I came about, one of my professors, Martha Sorensen, you know, she teaches sociology. I'm taking an intro to sustainability class with her. She has really, really changed a lot of minds at the school as far as getting people more involved in what your biological footprint is. You know, recycling, stop buying products that need to be recycled, and, you know, reusable water containers. And it really, you know, I was always into water conservation and such, but I wasn't focused so much on the recycling. She changed my mind and my attitude even further and got me involved into other people that I met through the Student Government Association, to where I joined the Environmental Club, to where last semester I got involved in the Recycle Day. I promoted that, helped out with that, and then it turned into this Earth Week. You know, this is a much on a bigger scale. And so now the people that I surround myself with are like-minded people, so it's helping me learn more and hopefully be a better person and contributing positively, you know.
James Titus is a student at Santa Fe Community College, and the Solar Fiesta and Earth Week are coming up starting on Monday, the 22nd of April, and going through that next weekend. If people want to find out more information, is there a website that they can look at?
Well, they can contact our coordinator, Janet Berry, and she is a great, great coordinator. She's put a lot of passion and a lot of time behind this. And they can contact her at Santa Fe Community College at 505-428-1266 for more information. And she'll give you all the information you need. I wanted to mention that this kicks off Monday the 22nd at Sirius Cycles at 2801 Rodeo Plaza, Rodeo Road on Rodeo Plaza, Suite C3. It's Sirius Cycles, where there's going to be a bicycle ride from there, from Rodeo Plaza to the community college. They'll be met by a group called the Harmony Drummers, so there'll be a big drum circle going on. And that kicks off into our resource fair Monday through Thursday between 10 and 2 will be the main resource fair in the main hallway. Also, we have Jemez Rooms 1, 2, and 3 reserved from 10 to 4, or from noon to 4, excuse me. And so there's a lot of activities going on with the films, ending with the film Baraka Thursday at 3 o'clock.
And so all of this is happening at the Santa Fe Community College. James Titus, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a great honor.